Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. May 25th, 2011, this is episode number 17, Everything Essential. Hi everyone, this is Kevin England. You know, from time to time, the topics that we want to cover in the podcast pile up over in the corner, and it is time to do a little bit of housekeeping around here. In this episode, we have a smidge of everything for you. Essential oils is the feature. New Jersey Division of Fish and Game wants you to be bear aware. A turn of events as a surprise guest interviews me for this podcast. And we're going to get to some listener questions to wrap things up. You know how things start if you hang around here. We start with the local hive report. I'm not going to belabor the point this week. Our bees are doing really well here in the late spring. The nectar flow is on. The pollen is absolutely crazy this year. It's been raining a lot, so it seems that the plants have a sufficient amount of moisture to create nectar. I'm not sure how to explain this, but it seems that the plants have held on a little longer than normal this year. Whatever the case may be, the bees are rocking. One of the hives we had, hive number one, was struggling to build out some comb up in the top. All of a sudden they started banging on that and they're starting to fill it with honey. And we ordered some new hive equipment last episode, talked about that. That has arrived, built it out, and actually I think we're going to put those new supers to good use this spring as everything's really going. In fact, on a whim, things have changed. We didn't have a spare hive. We used it for the swarm that I talked about last episode. I actually ordered another hive. Thought perhaps maybe we could consider a split and put a solid board in the middle of a full-size hive. And I also bought a nuke. I've never owned one, and I think it's about time to get into that kind of business. Also, spoke about possibly doing a split and donating partial hive to the Beekeepers Association. Figured if I had a nuke hanging around, I could contribute to the club. So that's the local hive report. Hive number one doing great. Hive number two busting at the seams. Hive number three with the swarm looks really good. They're building out their numbers. We're going to get in the boxes this weekend and see how everybody's doing. And again, haven't achieved that one objective that I want. Haven't seen any Varroa this spring so far, but July, August is the Varroa time frame, so you want to make sure that if you're going to put screen bottom boards under and you don't have them, it's time to do that. One other thing for everybody to consider is as the nectar flow is on, that's the time to replace your comb. We've talked about this over and over again. You should at least replace three combs this year, especially your really old stuff. Get the old comb with the old wax and the pesticide in it out of your box. Get those chemicals out. Rotate your comb. You have to do it now while the nectar flow is on. If you wait till the dearth of summer and they don't have it, then you're going to have to feed them sugar water in order to get them to produce the wax required. And, you know, quite frankly, I'm starting to not like the concept of sugar water. And I just think it's like feeding your kids candy. They should really be eating something nutritious, but that's a story for another show. That wraps it up for the local hive report. We're going to be right into segment number one. We're going to talk about essential oils. Daryl Denhalter, a listener from Layton, Utah, wrote in to share some experiences about his beekeeping exploits and answered my request about how beekeeping is going in his area of the country. Utah is not New Jersey, based on what Daryl shared with me. Daryl, along with others, have asked for some information concerning the use of essential oils. I mentioned on our last episode that I struggled to find something meaningful on the topic, but I'm not one to give up so easily, so I dug a little deeper and put together enough information to make this the feature of the week. If you've been a beekeeper for any period of time, then you're most likely familiar with the Varroa mite and its impact on the honeybee population. Varroa destructor was originally associated with Apis serrana, or the tropical Asian bee, and beekeepers have been looking for ways to control it since its jump to the European bee Apis mellifera. Essential oils can take the form of many ingredients, and I'm going to start this feature with a jump-off point. A commercially available product called Honeybee Healthy, or HPH as I'll refer to it on occasion in this podcast. But first, a disclaimer. I want to recognize that the use of essential oils have been around for a long time, and while HPH started in 1995, I'm sure that someone, somewhere, knew about essential oil use before the advent of this product. I add this so I don't get messages to me stating what I already know to be the obvious. I'm using the HPH discovery to tell a story, so hang in there with me. The creator of HPH, or Honey Bee Healthy, Robert Knoll, contacted West Virginia University and Jim Amrine after contacting 15 different universities with an idea that feeding essential oils to bees in combination with formic acid, not feeding them formic acid, but using formic acid, could keep the bees from dying. In an article about how this came about that I found online, it was said that Knoll got the idea from his sister, who was a registered nurse at the time and had planted the idea about the use of essential oils. I've heard also from other podcasts and other resources that hospitals used to use essential oils, wintergreen, and things like that as disinfectants, and I've mentioned that before on this program. A post on a forum on a well-known beekeeper site says this, quote, "He was quick to give his sister Marlene credit for pointing him in that direction. In nursing school, an instructor had extolled the virtues of essential oils in the natural world. She gave him no help in how he might apply that tidbit," unquote. Kind of funny quoting a forum item, but gives you a little insight into the background. Now, I have no way to know if that detail is exactly right, especially sourcing it from someone's accounting out to a forum, but according to the article that I found, and I'll provide a link to that, he did use wintergreen oil in his sugar water, and after soaking the whole hive and finding dead mites on the bottom board of the hive next day, the product development cycle took off from there. So from 1995 to 2000, Amrine and Noel tested several different oils diluted in honey and or sugar syrup, and eventually I'm guessing this led Noel to develop HPH. This isn't a history lesson of HPH, but there's one thing that interests me, and that is in the literature it talked about the approach that these two took. They decided to use oils and materials listed by the EPA that could be used for pest control activity, but would not require registration as an acaricide. Acaricide is defined as an agent, usually a chemical that kills mites and ticks. In that same article, there is a reference to the ingredients from which they could select from, and that's where I took the time to bring us to this point. So the list: acetic acid, beeswax, cinnamon, cloves, hydrogenated vegetable oil, linseed oil, mineral oil, olive oil, paraffin wax, safflower oil, wintergreen oil, vanillin, xanthan gum, and many others are of minimal risk, according to the listing. In addition, there were certain pesticide substances that are exempt, and they include cinnamon oil, citronella, lemongrass oil, mint and mint oil, peppermint, peppermint oil, and many others. So as an aside, perhaps one of these is tea tree oil. I'm not sure, but I hear that all the time in beekeeping commentary and products about it being an ingredient in essential oils. So now we have a list of things that could be sanctioned by the EPA and mixed or applied in various ways to help the beekeepers remove parasites from the hive in a natural way. So the million-dollar question, so what to use? In a CCD presentation from the University of West Virginia website, it comments that the mechanism of action of essential oils has yet to be defined, whether it is physical, mechanical, cytophylactic, etc., due to their complex nature. Now, if you look at the mix of things that I talked about, vegetable oils, why would you use a vegetable oil? Well, if you put it on the top bars and the bees pick it up, they become slippery, the varroa can't hold on. That's one. You could also use that vegetable oil as a delivery mechanism. It's natural stuff. If you look at wintergreen oil, you could look at, I'll get into that. But the bottom line is you could apply these things for various reasons in many different ways, and they're all technically kind of organic or inert or whatever. So an interesting aspect of this is that it appears that they're not sure if essential oils work inside the bee as a deterrent to the parasite feeding on them, to the bee's overall health by improving its immunity, or even by adjusting the health of the colony environment. Essential oils have two modes of action based on the West Virginia research: toxicity by direct contact and impaired reproduction of the varroa mite. Now, they've been used for other things too, but a lot of literature always focuses on varroa mite. When varroa mite contact essential oils such as wintergreen, patchouli, tea tree oil, et al., mixed into oil or grease, they are killed on contact and usually within a few minutes. That's why a lot of people will use grease patties. The grease patty makes it slippery, and the essential oil in there could potentially damage the varroa or kill them outright. When varroa mites feed on larvae that contain essential oils, their reproduction is interrupted. If the oil is strong enough, the females are unable to lay eggs. If the oils are in the lower concentration, eggs are laid, but development of immature mites is delayed. Young mites do not reach maturity before the bee emerges from the cell. Consequently, the immature mite dies. So, why do essential oils work? Let's take the concept of wintergreen. Wintergreen is often a misnomer. Methyl salicylate, S-A-L-I-C-Y-L-A-T-E, and I pronounced it wrong probably. There's an article for this on Wikipedia, and it says, oil of wintergreen is a natural product of many species of plant. Some of the plants which produce it are called wintergreens, hence the common name. If we look at a recent history, beekeepers have tried several options to control the varroa mite: powdered sugar, commercial products, drone brood frames, but lurking in the background are solutions that could emerge and help us to wage the war. From what I could see, one of the challenges for essential oils is delivery. In an interview with the Fat Bee Man in a recent Craig Yerden Organic Beekeeping podcast, I've talked about that before, the discussion about delivery to the bees was touched upon. The problem seems to be how to emulsify the products in the delivery mechanism, sugar, water, or honey, whatever you choose. It seems that if you want water and oil to mix, then you need to have a really powerful mixer, say a commercial grade blender for homemade batches. So a member of our association told me a story last week about a beekeeper that passed through our association espousing that essential oils would negate the use of chemicals, they were the second coming. The story ended with that individual suffering full losses of their hives due to the misuse of essential oils and subsequently leaving beekeeping. Done. On the internet, there are several formulas for mixing essential oils, and many of them include spearmint, wintergreen, and lemongrass oils. Another key ingredient is lecithin. Lecithin, let me say it right, and again, sorry, very tired here tonight, but lecithin is used in these concoctions to help emulsify the oil and the delivery of liquids. I keep talking about emulsify. What the heck am I talking about? If you've ever made Italian salad dressing with oil and vinegar, then you know that you really have to shake them up to get them to combine, and eventually they will separate again. If you put oil in sugar water, oil and water, no good, or honey, which contains water, it means the incorporation of these essential oils have to happen in emulsification in order for it to work. Now, I've watched my share of Alton Brown and Good Eats, and it's clear about breaking the oils up so that they incorporate with the fatty substances of the lecithin, and that is the key to keeping these products from separating. It creates this molecular bond. Go check out Good Eats. You'll figure it out. It appears that if you get these products to the bees directly, the oils could actually kill them outright, especially in straight doses and high concentrations. And when I say products, if they ate wintergreen oil or some of these concentrations directly, they could die. So obviously a mix-in seems to be required. Now, you may have noted that I'm saying it appears, it seems to be, it's reported. All this is because, quite frankly, there are not any magic formulas for mixing this stuff. There are a number of recipes for honeybee healthy knockoffs out on the web, and even one commercial supplier is creating a competing product to the HPH. But one funny thing is that unlike recipes for fondant, pollen, patties, or other beekeeping foods, there just doesn't seem to be an overabundance of recipes that tell you exactly how to use this stuff. So I'll give you a fair warning right now. If you get yourself a pen and a paper somewhere along the lines, I am going to give a recipe at the end of this segment. So in the last episode, I indicated that some beekeepers do not use smoke. They use a sugar solution spray, and one option is to incorporate an essential oil. Actually, this is an effective practice if you're going through the motions of combining two hives together, as with certain level of essential oils sprayed in the hive, you can cover up the pheromones in the hive, and when the smell wears off, the bees are blissfully unaware that newcomers have been added to the mix. In nature, a plant releases the substance that is the base of essential oils to attract beneficial insects to the plant to take care of less desirable creatures attacking the plant. That's from a Wikipedia article. In this way, essential oils are used as attractants, and swarm lures often use lemongrass oil to a good effect. Of course, this has its pros and cons for a beekeeper, as essential oils are implicated in robbing problems when employed overzealously. Another concern for liberal doses has been mentioned on this program, and it was mentioned in the winter Jennifer Berry presentation to the NJBA that I refer to on occasion. Sometimes the odor of the essential oil can mask the queen's pheromone, and the bees will wonder, as Jennifer put it, who is this big bug wandering around in our home? Now, a moment ago, I used the word dose. There is, in fact, a running tally of accounts of beekeepers taking Honey Bee Healthy and mixing it beyond the label directions. The product page even mentions, and I would say pseudo-endorses, this practice. A beekeeper had reported one time that their colonies were so badly affected that they were desperate, so they poured this potent concoction directly on the bees in frames, soaked them, so to speak. The bees cleaned up the mess, and then miraculously rebounded. After the first success was foretold, many other beekeeping operations have performed this same operation with the same outcome. It's an interesting finding to me and is analogous to the propolis in the hive that I talk about. Propolis, collected from nature, bears plant immunity response to insects. Plants create this sticky resin, and it takes care of the insects trying to feed on the plant. The bees bring it back, and they're getting that immunity from the plants, and the diversity helps the immunity in the hive. My hives are mucky with the stuff. I only rarely scrape out the propolis when I just can't get a frame undone, but I leave as much of it intact as I can in the hives. So I don't think I could get away without talking of a recipe or two. I found a recipe on the Beekeepers Association of the Ozark, who, incidentally, have a link to our podcast. How's that for serendipity? And thanks to those folks for that. Their website address is Ozarks with an S, beekeepers.org. A contribution in their forum from Royce, R-O-Y-C-E, has this recipe. Here we go. 5 cups of water, 2.5 pounds of sugar, 1/8 teaspoon of lecithin granules, used as the emulsifier, as I've said a couple times, 15 drops of spearmint oil, 15 drops of lemongrass oil. The process for making up the solution is as follows. Bring the water to a boil and integrate the sugar until dissolved. Once the sugar is dissolved, remove the mixture from the heat and quickly add the lecithin and essential oils. Stir everything together until it is evenly distributed. Cool before using. Now, one tip that I read from several sources, by the way, is to soak the lecithin granules if you're going to use them. Soak them overnight and stir them in just before use. It helps them to mix in better. There's one comment in the forum, and that is from the vice president of that organization. As of January 2010, it is that some essential oils are not food grade and could be made with solvents. Again, back to my TV show, that's not good eats. Seems a prudent thing to look out for. And by the way, this same recipe is listed on a page of beekeeping formula recipes that I've been to several times. That address, EN, the letters E as in Edward, N as in Nancy, .wikibooks.org/wiki/beekeeping. I will provide a link to that, of course, in the show notes. You know, I think I've just scratched the surface of essential oils, and there are many more practices and research activities in progress. If you go to Google Scholar and you look it up, there's many different things underway. As I said, I think there'll be an explosion of this. Varroa, prevention of American fowl brood, and other ailments are being studied. The use of mineral oil, lemon juice, marjoram, citronella, and a whole host of other products are either being rediscovered and opening as possible new frontiers for integrated pest management options. And I'm guessing that we haven't heard the last of essential oils on this program. So I've mentioned a couple times, you can head over to our show notes to get some information. Our website address is www.bkcorner.org. You could send me an email at kevin@bkcorner.org if you had any questions, corrections, or comments about this segment. You could also call and leave us a message on our phone in the U.S., 609-460-4037, dialing outside the U.S., use the number 1 and the U.S. country code. Be honest with you, don't dial it, so I can't say I can help you with that. That's it for essential oils. Hope you enjoyed this. And if you have formulas that you want to share with the users that work for you, send a note over to the address that we just gave you. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back with more from the Beekeeper's Corner podcast right after this. Joking with Sharon the other day in passing about how folks write into the podcast and provide the feedback, and inevitably so many people make a comment about how they enjoy Sharon appearing on the podcast. So I've been pestering her over the last number of days, saying something to her about maybe she wanted to record something for the podcast. Well, the other day Sharon went in for a same day surgery, and we were hanging out in the waiting room waiting for her to wheel her away. And we got onto the conversation about the podcast, and I told her about a recent comment from a fan, and we were just joking around and really in a goofy mood, and she decided to indulge me in an interview. I won't say any more, and you can hear some of her handiwork. Here we go.
Name and rank.
Kevin England. Beekeeper.
So, why are you into beekeeping?
Because you got me involved.
But you so into it.
It's like a puzzle. It's really a lot of fun, honestly. Once I got involved, I really want to understand it. I won't let it beat me. It's kind of my nature. You know how I am, Sharon. I'm type A. When I get involved in something, I jump in wide open if it's an interest to me. And this beekeeping thing is really fascinating, don't you think?
And all-consuming.
You know, what's wrong with spending time with your
bees.
With your hobby? Not with your wife. with your hobby, right? It's a new hobby, and I really enjoy it, and it's good.
Do you get stung often?
I get stung on occasion, mostly when I'm dumb. You know, if I go out with my suit on or my veil and I'm just taking a peek, no, I never get stung. Even when I go out without my suit or my veil or whatever and are just observing, I don't get stung. I usually get stung when I'm in working the bees and I do something that causes me to get stung. Our bees in the early spring, I remember, were really pretty aggressive, but it was cool outside and I was in the hive a little bit here and there. It really does unnerve me when they start bouncing off your head and buzzing you menacingly. I know you're supposed to be as a seasoned beekeeper calm or whatever, but I do get pretty nervous about it. And when I do, on occasion I get stung. Mostly in the hands, which I hate.
So, will you have any liquid gold this year? Honey?
I think we will have some honey. Hive number two is building comb and stored in honey, so yeah, I think we'll be able to spin that one out. And the honey flow looks like it's going to run here through the rest of May. And for some reason, hive one isn't building honey, but we're going to solve that problem. And yeah, I think we'll have some honey to speak of this year.
The third hive, the swarm. Is it time to build up on their supers or yet?
We have we have two boxes out there right now. I just kind of stuck bees in there and left them to their own device. They're a swarm. I'm assuming they want to build a colony. They've got some built-out comb. I peeked in on it actually this morning before we got going today, and the bees are coming and going. I looked down into the lid. They're looking like they're working in there, and I see they've cleaned some of the debris out from the, you know, we gave them old comb from old hives that we knew was okay, and they're cleaning the comb, and I can see the debris outside the entrance, so I think they're in pretty good shape. One of the things I got to do is get the screen bottom board underneath them so that they won't have issues with varroa later this year, but I think they're going to ramp up into a full-blown hive pretty quickly.
Awesome. We never heard from the farmer next door about spraying pesticide.
Yeah, the field is growing, and he seems to be a little kind of behind schedule, or maybe I'm wrong. Don't they usually plant the corn for delivery in July?
I do kind of remember it being late last year, too.
Yeah, so they're just planting cow corn in there. So, yeah, if you're home during the day and you happen to see him, probably be best to go out and have a little chat with him, and if I see him, I'll do the same. At some point, maybe we should just give him a call. We know who it is. I saw, was over to Stan's last weekend and asked him, his field next to him had corn in it, and he talked to the farmer, and the farmer gets it now with all the pesticides and stuff and rotated the corn to a different area of his farm so that Stan's bees wouldn't be affected from it, and, you know, that's pretty cool. Pretty cool dialogue between a beekeeper and a farmer.
What'd the farmer plant in the field?
I think he said they were going to plant soybean or something else in there. But he's also talked to him about application of pesticides and is encouraging to take more organic processes, which is what we talked about with our guy, having a chat with him to do the same thing. So,
great. Awesome.
Cool.
Out of questions.
Well, thank you for this little session. That's very nice.
Dun, dun, dun.
Signing off. So I know people are going to ask how Sharon's doing, if You wanted to know she's doing great. It's been about a week or so since we recorded that, and she's healing fine and just doing great. And she says hello to everybody. She was joking that she couldn't understand how she could possibly have some fans, but whatever the case may be, I will try and do what I can to get her to come on down here and record every once in a while. I wanted to make note that we went away this past weekend to a Boy Scout crossover. My son is now officially a Boy Scout from a Cub Scout. And when we got home, we found the farmer working over there in the field, and I took the opportunity to walk over and talk to him. And it's always a good sign when they shut the machine off and actually have a conversation with you. And we talked for probably about 45 minutes or so. He was really interested in the bees, and he always has been. He's a landscaper by trade, farmer by night, and knows a lot about the pesticides and other things that go on. And we had a great dialogue. I explained to him about the neonicotinoids and the seed dressings that come. The unfortunate thing for us is that he's already purchased the seed for the corn that he's going to plant there, but he was willing to take my email address, and he's going to send me the information about the product that he's going to put into the field. And also, he's going to put some Roundup down to keep the weeds down and so on. He's going to call us before he did it. He did that last year for us so we can keep the bees closed up for a day or so. And is really willing to work with us. And one of the other things that I asked him, and I encouraged our Beekeepers Association to do the same, if you live nearby to a farmer, go over and have this dialogue with him. Ask him if he would consider, he or she, don't want to be bias there, would consider the possibility of planting organically, and it can't hurt to ask. I also asked him, quite frankly, if he knew any other farmers or was a part of some sort of co-op or whatever where we could have an audience, and I'm trying to encourage our Beekeepers Association to consider those options and go down to the Extension Center and see if we could start a dialogue. I listened to a podcast recently from Phil Chandler, and sorry, my chair is squeaking. It had to do with organic beekeeping and what they call the slow movement. They got that from slow food movement. And one of the things they talked about in there was organic farming and the impact to the beekeeping industry, and the fact that the beekeeping industry is almost like a canary in a coal mine. We are the barometers for the health of the nation. And this should be a wake-up call, and no, I'm not going to start sounding the alarm or whatever, but it really is a good idea for us as beekeepers to be the front line and have a conversation with our farmers. Even if we convert a handful of them over to not using pesticides, or at least considering their options. And quite frankly, folks, these people own the land. They have to pay a lot of taxes on them. They have to make their money back. Yield in crop and other things are a consideration for them. I don't blame them for doing what they have to do, but when you spell things out to them like certain pesticides are going to remain in the soil and possibly poison the rest of the environment and other things like that, and you could provide them some data about it. I sent our farmer a couple of things. He was interested in the swarm that I discussed in the last episode. I sent him a link to the video, and I also sent him a talk on beekeepers talking about pesticides and the impact to the bees. Fascinated by it, wanted the data, and I sent it over. So I guess that's all I'm going to say about that. Have a dialogue with your local farmer. Thanks to Sharon for that fun interview. We'll see if we can get her to show up a little more here on the podcast. We have this email delivery of notifications for our company that, quite frankly, nobody seems to read that much. But the other day I happened to go into it, and lo and behold, there was something there, a public service announcement about Be a Good Neighbor, Be Bear Aware. The company sent some information over about bears because one of our facilities is in a rural area and there have been bear sightings in the neighborhood. Pretty fascinating, and they posted over something that came from New Jersey Fish and Wildlife. And it says that black bears are getting a lot of attention these days for the wrong reasons. They're venturing too close to homes and into backyards looking for food. Bears that look for food near your home or in your yard have likely learned bad habits from people who feed them intentionally or unintentionally by carelessly leaving out food or garbage. I must admit, and I think I've shared this on the podcast, that we tend to, shall we say, compost by taking anything that is trash and dumping it out in the backyard. We attract critters, sometimes we see fox, possums, things like that, but we've yet to encounter a bear, but certainly if you have bears around, you do not want to follow this practice. You got to use bear-proof garbage cans, you want to make sure you store your garbage in airtight containers. One of the things they'll tell you is to put it inside a garage or only put it out the morning that garbage pickup is coming up. Don't take it outside. Make sure you wash your garbage cans so they don't smell like food. Be careful when you feed the birds, feed the dogs, feed the cats and all that. Anytime basically you're leaving something that will attract the bear that they can smell and want to consume, they will go into your property and you're basically feeding them unknowledgeably. Now, the brochure indicates that you should pick up fruit that has fallen from your trees daily and throw it away. You should consider electric fences for crops, beehives, small livestock if you live in an area with a large population. I don't have a large population, but you've heard me comment that I am considering a bear fence, and lo and behold, something comes across from the New Jersey Beekeepers Association for a seminar on how to put up a bear fence. That's going to happen on June 1st, and I think what I'm going to do is reach out to those folks and see if they'll allow me to come in and do a little bit of coverage for that. So a representative, his name is Greg Miller of the Gallagher Fencing Company, is coming out to Somerset, New Jersey on June 1st to do a presentation on how an electric fence works, what the installation and maintenance would be, and problems that you would have commonly observed in New Jersey and the right type of fence that you would put up. I'm looking to see if I could get over there for this free clinic. And I'm going to send an RSVP. I have permission from the boss to attend. So I am going to ask them if we could possibly do a little coverage for the Beekeepers Association and or the podcast here. So stay tuned and we'll see if we can get some of that. If you're interested in more information about being bear aware, you could visit the website for New Jersey Fish and Wildlife at newjerseyfishandwildlife.com. And I guess the key instrumental message is don't feed them. That's the thing they want to ensure that you're not doing. And incidentally, as a side note, it is a crime in New Jersey. You could face a penalty. It's been a long day, folks. I had a 14-hour workday today. And I know I have mumble mouth, so you'll have to bear with me. But I am so dead set on recording a podcast here and getting something out that I figured I'd slide behind the microphone. But anyway, illegal to feed the bears, you could face a penalty of up to $1,000. That's it. Be bear aware. I mentioned this episode was a little bit about housekeeping, so let me pull this little dust bunny out from underneath the table. I was postulating why one of our hives seems to have changed race of bees. We started with Carniolians last year. Both hives went Carniolian all the way through. In the spring, Carniolian. And then all of a sudden, we know that we got a swarm, and we know that we have some queen cells in there, or whatever. But how does one switch one race to another? I told everyone that I was going to ask this question, and actually I found the answer from my Beekeepers Association, or at least something that seems like a plausible theory, so I thought I'd bring it back to the show. One of the beekeepers suggested to me, and this came from a conversation about bee congregation areas. So there's been a lot of hubbub about a recent video where someone was able to strap some bees, bee suits on these bees, especially a queen, and watch her go out and actually mate with a bunch of males in the singles bar, if you care to call it that, in the sky. This was the joke of the Beekeepers Association meeting last week. The bee congregation area is where all the drones hang out, and it was funny the commentary that people had about how the bee congregation area is actually like a local hangout, that the bees will come back there time and time again if you have a consistent apiary. But anyway, I know that as the crow flies for me, probably 3/4 of a mile or less, there are probably 20 hives in the vicinity. A pretty large farm organization is, for all intent and purposes, across the field and across the street from me. And there are numerous hives over there, and they are probably Italian bees. Ding, 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 ding. I think we've found the answer as to what's going on. My queen is over to the other side of the neighborhood, hanging out with the Italian boys. So it is possible that they got over there, or that maybe the genetic stock inside my hive had a little bit of Italian in it, and it came through. But I'm not really happy about that. My question is, leave well enough alone, or go back and get a Cornelian queen, raise it out of my other box that is still appears to be Cornelian stock. The bees look like they originally did. Could grow a queen out of there in my new nuke and put it back in the box. Really what I'm looking for is, I didn't like the characteristics of the Italian bee that we had before. And the fact of the matter is, they had to be fed a lot, they didn't seem to do very good housekeeping, and they were lazy flyers. They didn't want to fly when it was early and cold, unlike the Cornelian bees that just totally amazed me this year. So anyway, there's an answer to one of the riddles of life. The queen, my lovely queen, has been out hanging out with the Italian boys over at the neighbor's house, and we have a change. And when we pulled the swarm off the tree, that's really when I noticed the change, and I guess I should be more observant. You know, sometimes bees change a litter, or you look at them and you don't really look at them. In this case, they're definitely yellow and a different color. They appear, though, that they're the same size. How do I say this? The Italian bees that we had before seem larger in size than the Cornelians that we have and can compare against in hive number one. But whatever the case, our bees definitely have a distinct yellow tone to them now, and I think I have what is a possible plausible answer to one of the queries that came up recently. Why have my bees changed? I get a reasonable number of emails on occasion asking questions, and most times what I do when I get the emails is try to build in the answers to those in the next episode that come through. But the number of questions coming through sometimes outweigh what we can stuff into the podcast, so I thought I'd do a listener questions section. So I'll take a representative sample of things from listeners that wrote in and or from some of our beekeepers who are new and working with our association, and asked a couple questions at our Beekeepers Association meeting that occurred recently. So the first one, I opened the episode with the mention of listener Daryl Denhalter from Utah. Daryl's a beekeeper and had a handful of questions, so let's see if we can help him out. The first one, he wanted to know what we know about queen excluders and are they necessary or recommended? Queen excluders are used for a handful of purposes, but fundamentals first. The simple description is that the construction of the device keeps the queen from passing from one part of the hive to another. It's ironic that this question came through because I've never owned a queen excluder and just bought some with that purchase that I was talking about last week. And I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do with them, but gotta have the gadgets, right? So one of the most common uses for a queen excluder is to separate the brood chamber from the honey supers. The reason this is desirable is you don't want to have brood mixed in with your honey that you're going to extract. Me personally, I don't recall seeing any brood in any of the honey supers we've employed. There is also a key point to this. If you're putting honey supers on that have foundation and not drawn comb and you stick a queen excluder in there, it is likely that your bees will not pass through it, even though they are small enough to do so, because the barrier just negates them from going up there. Do not employ the use of a queen excluder between your brood chambers and your honey supers if you don't have drawn comb upstairs. By the way, I've covered this before, but nomenclature for new beekeepers is useful to revisit every once in a while. Hive bodies usually come in large, medium, and small. In beekeeping parlance, they're called a deep, a medium, and a shallow. The size of the box or hive body is referred to as a super when it is put above the brood chamber for the purpose of collecting honey. Now, not to confuse anyone, but some beekeepers put their honey chambers under their brood chambers. For simplicity purposes, supers usually go above the brood chamber. Moving on. Sometimes beekeepers will want to separate an artificial split but use the same hive stack. The technique is this. Put two hive bodies on a bottom board, and above the brood chamber you would put a queen excluder. You would put two more deeps above it. Here's the difference. The two deeps above get a burgeoning hive with a queen, brood, and attendants with the purpose of growing another hive. Why use this technique? The top box can leverage the heat from the bottom box, and bees can even cross from one hive into the other, kind of like bees on loan. This technique is another topic, but demonstrates one other way that a queen excluder is used. I'm not going to go crazy about queen excluders. You get the gist is they're to separate different chambers. Let's move on to another question. Daryl asked about using a container over the brood chamber to feed the bees. This is a common practice. Place a jar, a plastic bucket, or some sort of vessel over the brood chamber, inverted with holes that allow the food to weep through for the bees to consume. Daryl, perfectly fine technique, and you see it commonly employed in beekeeping. You mentioned that you put the hive body around it. That's how you do it. The only addition I might add to your formula is to fill the empty space around the container with something that serves like insulation. Maybe you want to put some balled up newspaper or whatever to keep that there. You know, the way you do this is you place that inverted jar over top of the inner cover and they come up through the hole to the feeder. If you can kind of secure around the vessel, then the heat doesn't escape as much. And also, it concentrates the heat on the vessel. Presumably, you do this type of a technique when it's cool outside, and the heat coming out of the hive through that inner cover hole will keep whatever liquid it is somewhat warm. So, one more question for the pile. Daryl also asked, how do you keep a smoker lit? And I know I've touched upon this in the podcast before, but this is a great opportunity for me to say that I just created a video demonstrating this recently. If you head over to the Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers Association page on the multimedia section, there is a video about this. Address for that, nwba.njbeekeepers.org. We'll put a note to that in the show link. The process goes like this to answer the question. Light a piece of paper, put it in the bottom chamber of your smoker. While it is burning, add some fuel and let the fuel start burning too. We use pine needles here because they're readily available to us. You obviously want to use them when they're dry, not soaking wet. You slowly add additional fuel, but don't tamp it down and jam it in there. Right now what you're doing is you're trying to get that bottom layer of fuel to burn with the paper. Add a little puff to the smoker, add a little fuel, add a little puff, add a little fuel, puff the smoker. What you're trying to do is get that bottom chamber smoldering while it's loosely to medium pack. Once the smoke is consistent, you can add as much fuel as you think you're going to need for the session you have, and you're going to tamp it down a little bit tighter with your hive tool. As you puff the smoker, eventually it will burn up from the bottom of the chamber and should provide you with a smoker that will be lit after visiting your hives. And I typically have to bring mine back, open it up, puff it, let it burn out, and then after an hour or two, I go and I dump the remains out in the yard somewhere and make sure that they don't start a fire. So last but not least, one of the questions you asked, how about that beekeeping merit badge for Boy Scouts? So if you're not familiar with this, they discontinued it, and I haven't heard anything there. I did sign that petition that a young man was doing to bring it back, and we plan to do some additional beekeeping stuff with our particular troop. So I'm all for it. I'd like to see them bring that back, and hopefully someday they will. Let's move on to listener Seth Herman. I want to give a moment to shout out to Seth Herman from Massachusetts. Seth sent us a note about his experiences as a beekeeper, and he shared a story, a new one on me, about a deer attacking his hives. He made a comment about the ants that are making their way into his hive for the sugar water, and I've received questions about this in the past. What do you do about that? So let me tackle that. I've seen ants on our inner cover, and for the most part, I ignore them, is the answer. They'll lay eggs and build a huge nest on top, but I never see them actually literally going down into the chamber. It just might be the type of ants that I have. Don't know what everybody else is dealing with. If you can't stand this and don't like to have ants crawling all over you, and I get that when the ants are in there and you take the inner cover off and they're all over. The ones we had were actually biting, so that was a pain. You could put the ant baits down underneath the hive if you have that ability. That will draw the ants in, but the bees typically ignore all that stuff. Do understand that that's a pesticide you put in there. If the ants are getting in it and they take it into the hive, you're adding chemicals to your hive. But for the most part, it's usually innocuous. Another option is you can buy these pedestals from some of the beekeeper suppliers. They raise the platform up off of the ground, and then it has a barrier where you pour water, oil. You can even grease the bottom of your hive if you're so inclined. And as the bees walk through it, they either can't pass through the barrier or they get grease all over them and they can't continue. So that's another way you can do it. Let's go to a handful of questions we had at our local beekeepers association. A new beekeeper asked, do I always need to feed my new hive? And if I continue to do this, is it going to hurt anything? Will it hurt? For the most part, the standard answer is no. So new bees do need nectar to build comb. New bees, if ramping up when there is no nectar, need to be fed sugar water so that they can make wax. Common wisdom is if they have nectar, they'll use that instead and not take the sugar water. To answer the question, can too much be too much? Yes, you can feed them too much. It is a possibility. Be careful that they are not getting so much sugar water that they take everything and pack the hive through every nook and cranny so much that they cannot lay brood and build eggs. You're defeating your purpose of trying to ramp the colony up. So do your inspections. Look for a balance of brood, and you're looking for cap brood, you're looking for eggs, you're looking for larvae, you're looking for pollen, and you're looking for honey storage. If you go back and listen to our episode about fall management, you'll know that we're looking for ultimately at the end of the season 10 frames of honey and a combination of brood, pollen, and other resources in the hive. So that's what you're targeting for. Another question came out about drones. What does it mean when I have a ton of drones in my hive? This is really not so much a new hive type of situation. So typically you get a package of bees. They don't include a lot of hives, but when you come out of a winter session and you start to see a lot of drones, it could signal a couple things. It could just be that your queen likes to do drones. It could be your queen can't lay fertile eggs and she's building non-workers or drones. It could be that she's ready to swarm and she's creating enough drones so that she can go away and her daughters can mate. Is drone population a big problem in a hive? I personally don't worry about it. I see tons of drones in my hive, and I think that's the natural order of things. There's a commentary about using drone brood frames in a new hive. Do you have to do it? We actually had a feature. Bob Kloss, one of our beekeepers, did a great job, and his presentation about drone brood frames will be available at the Northwest Beekeepers Association. He talked about drone culling and whether you should do it. So new beekeepers, do you need to have drone brood culling? You know, one of the wisdoms that I heard from a pretty experienced beekeeper is typically a new package, nuke, or whatever that's deployed in a hive just generally doesn't see Varroa problems. I guess there's no absolute, but living the experience of building two new hives last year and having them overwinter, we had no Varroa last year at all. I do expect on year number two here in July and August when the Varroa come to fruition that we're going to have to be careful and make sure we do our Varroa counts and so on. So do you need to use a drone brood frame? Not exactly sure if that's needed for a new beekeeper. If you're an experienced beekeeper, yes, you probably could try that. One other thing, a sidebar about drone brood frames. I do believe in them. I have a couple. I do use them. But when you're culling the drones like that, you are taking care of disrupting the hive balance and the natural order of things. I guess in a roundabout way, the Varroa is not a natural order of things. So everything that we're doing in there, other than leaving them in a box alone, is interfering with things. So,
Stay on task, Kevin. You're meandering here. Next question. When you replace the frames, which I recommended earlier in this episode, do you have to use foundation? Well, actually, no, you don't. When you're replacing a frame, you could choose a frame without any foundation and a starter strip, or actually you could just put a plain one in there and see if they can figure that out. A lot of times they will. The point of it is you don't want to put an empty frame alongside something that has just plain foundation or, you know, is on the end frame and away from the edge of the box. You want to maintain the bee space. Your best bet is to use two mature built-out comb frames on the outside of a foundationless frame, and the bees will build with bee space in there, thanks to Mr. Langstroth's ideas. So that was another question that was fielded, and you know, can you get away with a frame that does not have foundation? You know, when you try to spin it, and it depends on how you harvest your honey, some people do crush and strain. Other people definitely put it in a machine. If you're going to do foundationless frames, some people run wire and no frames, and the bees will build that, and the wire will serve the structure. Others will allow that frame to mature a little bit in the comb and harden as it sits in the, you know, as the bees use it and walk over it and do other things. Eventually, that wax stiffens up enough to be able to go ahead and spin it out. If you damage your comb when you're spinning it out, it's not necessarily the end of the world because you started with a blank frame. So to each his own, your experiences will vary. You know, most people say that if you put a frame that had no foundation in a spinner and you are gentle with it, you should be able to get away with it. Okay, I think I got time for one more. Question was asked, when you start a new hive, when do you add new boxes to the top of the hive? Fair enough question. The answer is generally this. When the bees build out to the outside of the box and you have one empty frame to the outside, it's a good time to go ahead and put that second box on the top. In New Jersey, the typical configuration is you use one deep on the bottom, you put a second deep on the bottom, and then if you're fortunate enough that the bees have built out two full deeps, then you would start putting whatever you choose on the top. If you're after honey production, you probably want to use a medium or a shallow so that you can lift it, but some beekeepers are brawn enough to put the full big old deep right on top. They'll go three deeps, then they'll start doing shallows. You know, at some point you get past the point of return when the thing is 8 feet high and you need a stepladder. I don't think you'll be wanted dealing with a deep there. So typical answer, wait till the bees build it out to about the build out eight full combs, and then when they get to the outside you want to add another hive body and build from there. Same idea, and again, objective number one, you can't say it enough, is when you have a new hive, you're looking to get the hive built out and get it through September, October, and set up to overwinter. And let's not forget, folks, it may only be the end of May, but soon enough, it'll be time to make sure that you take care of those varroa mites, July and August, and you will make sure that your bees are going to survive over winter. And you know, this brings up a topic that came up recently. The winter losses for our area came through, and it was an interesting report. This is on the homepage of the Northwest website. 65% of the beekeepers lost, reporting losses, did not do any treatments. 71% did varroa treatments with powdered sugar. So if people who treated with varroa sugar, let me turn that around, had 71% losses. I'm going to come back to that in a second. If they treated with Apistan, it was 68%. If they treated with Kumafos, it was 47%. If they treated with Apilife Var, it was 25%. One out of four hives lost. If they treated with formic acid, it was 24%. And those that treated with Epigard had an 18% loss. So why is it 71% for those who treated with powdered sugar? I'm going to surmise that people didn't do it correctly. I've seen powdered sugar demos, and I've heard talks from beekeepers who explain how to do it, and I think they missed the mark. The common theory is that you need to do both boxes. You need to use at least a cup of sugar, or it's recommended 3/4 to a cup of sugar for each box. You need to sprinkle the top box, and then you need to take the second box and sprinkle that one. And it's ideally done over a screened bottom board. And you need to repeat that procedure at least once a week until your mite counts drop to a reasonable level. I think a lot of people do powdered sugar. They open a box, they dump the powdered sugar in on the top, they bang it down, and they don't come back and do it anymore, and they don't understand why it doesn't work. If you listen back a couple episodes, we talked about the findings of powdered sugar and how effective it is over a period of time. And if you don't apply the regimen correctly, then you're not doing the correct IPM. Other thing is people treating with formic acid that's illegal in New Jersey. Now, if I have that correct, it's illegal in New Jersey, but they're just about to come out and have approved with MitAway 2 quick strips, and those are formic acid, from what I understand. I'll have to do a feature on those. Just haven't looked into it. There's been all this buzz about it, and I said last time I would. Haven't gotten there yet, so. But there are commercial beekeepers and others in New Jersey, for what it's worth, using formic acid, and they are using it successfully. So what brought me to this topic? When do you treat for varroa mite? 48% of the losses incurred in our area were beekeepers who started their treatments for varroa after August. If you go to those that are following the advice to treat from mid-July through August and beyond until the mite load is down, only a 17% loss. Also on that website, our website, and Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers, is a link to the AIA USDA loss report. AIA is the Apiary Inspectors of America. That's on our beekeeping research and news. They have the USDA winter loss survey there that you can check out. So, you know, I post this stuff to the beekeepers, or to the Beekeeper's Corner podcast webpage, but why double link it? It could send you over there. I maintain both the sites, so I'm just going to save myself a little bit of work here. So that's it for listener questions. If you have any, you certainly could feel free to phone them in. We gave the information earlier on how to contact us. You can send me an email, kevin@bkcorner. I'd be happy to hear from you, and I'll do my best to get you guys some answers. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back to finish off the show here and go through a couple final housekeeping items, and then we'll set you on your merry way. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back right after this.
Hey there, how you doing, ma'am? Would you like to hold my hand? I've been waiting here for you. Never thought we'd get this far. We caught lights in mason jars. Seems like yesterday we met at school. You had me chasing lollipop Indians. If I got one, I'd steal a kiss or two. What the hell'd you save me for? They didn't work at candy stores. Every mouth in class was turning blue. If it made you stop and smile, I'd sit down and work a while. I guess things never change like they should. Promise me we'll never stray too far from who we were those days. An innocence that I can better lose. I wouldn't change a thing if I could choose.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Beekeeper's Corner podcast. If I sound a little bit refreshed, it's a little secret I'll let you in on. I recorded the outro last night and came back and listened to it today in post-production, and it just, I was so tired I could hardly put it together. So, you know what, I nuked it, and I'm going to do it over again. Today is the 26th, and actually a couple of interesting things happened today, so I get to throw that into the podcast here to close things out. So, oh, phone is ringing. Hang on a minute. Well, I'm back, and wouldn't you know it, that was Kathy, who is doing the bear fence seminar that I mentioned earlier. I called her up to see if she would be okay if I come over and did some coverage, and yes, all things are confirmed, so that's pretty cool. Another neat thing going on here for the podcast and for the Beekeepers Association, so let me carry on where I left off. This afternoon, a article showed up on the New Jersey Beekeepers blog that reminded me of a topic I wanted to cover at some point. A Northwest New Jersey branch member, one of ours, asked, is it a good time to go 9 frames in the bottom box when you build out a new hive and you're ready to put the second box on the top? The answer was yes. Good time to move from 10 frames to 9 is when you're adding the second brood box. So for those who have not heard of this practice, why would you run 9 in the bottom box? Well, a lot of times a seasoned beekeeper will tell you that they would prefer to run 9 in the bottom versus 10. It gives the beekeeper a little more room when doing inspections. If you have 10 frames in that hive and it's maintaining the bee space and you have a tremendous amount of bees, like I described a little bit earlier for our situation, when you pull that 10th frame, sometimes you tend to roll the bees and you could possibly have the queen in there and damage or kill the queen. So some beekeepers like to have a little more room to work with. Now, when you have 9 frames in the bottom box, you should know that that means the space is somewhere in there in a typical Langstroth, and the bees are going to build bridge comb, or call it burr comb, whatever you want to refer to it as, and they are going to brace everything up. You could still pry that last frame off, get a little more room, and have time to open it up and not damage the bees. So it's your preference whether you want to do that. I have 10 frames in my box, and we just deal with it. I've also seen in the beekeeping catalogs the spacers that you can use to space the frames. It always looked to me that they were spaced apart, and I always thought common sense would dictate that you would set a frame shoulder to shoulder in order to maintain the B space between the faces of the comb. But people have different methodologies, and some people like to have that frame a little wider out. The bees will build thicker comb there and still maintain the B space. I guess it's really up to the beekeeper. So there is one other compelling reason to run 9 frames in a box, but it's not in the brood chamber, it's in the honey super. A lot of beekeepers, when they set up a honey super, will set 9 frames in the box instead of 10, and they will purposely spread them out a little bit. The byproduct of performing this activity is that there's more space, the bees will build a deeper comb. The good news for that is deeper comb sticks out beyond the face of the edge of the top of the frame, and when you pull it out to extract it and you want to uncap it, the wax is sticking up a little bit. You could cut the capping off and you'll have maybe a little more wax in the frame, or a little more honey in the frame, I should say. So that's a clever trick for those that are there. The one thing I would say to everybody is if you are going to run a 9-frame system in a 10-frame box, the suggestion would be that you would put all of those frames right over top of each other so you can maintain the space. If they're misaligned there, you're actually changing the ventilation inside the hive, and you're also creating challenges for the bees to move up and down inside the space. Hope you found that helpful, and actually now it's time for a Kevin moment. A listener wrote in one time and asked me if I have some sort of babbling brook in the middle of my office. Actually, what you hear running in the background, if you have good enough speakers, is my fish tank. And as I turn around and take a peek at it right now, it's down probably a couple inches and the filter is pouring water out. And it does sound like it has a lot of babbling brook kind of sound to it. So I guess it's time for me to put some more water in there. I have a 55-gallon tank with a couple goldfish, a couple neons, and things like that. So that is the reason why you hear water flowing in the background often on the podcast. Kevin, moment over. Let me close with one last parting article. I received an email this afternoon from Ian Dickinson. He's calling in a relative sense of the term. Deputy Principal PYP Coordination, the Bucklands Beach Intermediate School in New Zealand, sent a note saying the group of Y7 students that they have in the organization are interested in bees as a positive way of enhancing our local environment. They wanted to know if we would participate in some question and answers, so I'm going to take a break from the podcast after the production and send a note back and say, sure, send over any questions that you have. They were looking if anyone local to that area would be interested in visiting the school and talking about the positive benefits of beekeeping on the environment. I know we have some listeners in New Zealand. I have no idea where this school is, but if you're interested in finding out more about this and possibly giving them, how cool would that be for this podcast to generate a visitor over at their school? That would really close the loop. So if you're interested in that and you can help out, kevin@bkcorner.org is the place to send a note. In the meantime, we're going to send off something to Ian Dickinson and tell him to send over the messages. We'd be happy to hear anything about beekeeping from our students over in New Zealand. Time to wrap up this episode. It's been a long one, but we appreciate you staying with us. We hope you found everything useful, and if you have some questions or ideas for the podcast, you could always send a note over to kevin@bkcorner.org. We'll post all our show notes at www.bkcorner.org, and you can call us on the phone and leave us a message, 609-460-4037 is the answering machine, and again, sometimes I do answer the phone when you call, so give me a ring, be happy to hear from you. Thanks everybody for listening, we'll catch you next time on the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. The alarm clock's beeping, I turn it off. I wanna keep on sleeping, it's too late. The song's already playing. And
my feet start moving. Out the door, see what the fall is bringing. Just in time to hear the baddies leaving. On my board, and my wheels all rattling. And it sounds like music to me. Leaves falling down. Music to me. At the beach, it's town these only. No need to hate, but everyone knows me. Meeting up to see what's going on. And it won't be long till we're hanging out at a back house party. I hurry up, it's already started. And by everyone, it's locals only. And it sounds like music to me. Leaves falling down.
Sounds like music.
No one around.
Sounds like music.
All day, all night.
Sounds like music.
Except it down, but never bring me down. Cause it all sounds like music to me. The weather starts to change, the music starts to play, and I can finally hear.